for Sincerely Jennifer with me, Jennifer Wan.
What's going on with you? Happy Sunday, or happy whenever you are listening to this, I guess. I think you know what I mean, right? I'm over it. You know? I'm not saying that, like, we should ignore the fact that we are obviously in a very serious situation right now, worldwide. But I mean, no. I'm not going to be like one of those people that's like, open the Greggs, you bastards, you know, protesting in the streets. But I must say, even though I understand the necessity of all this business, I have definitely had enough. But I've been working on lots of things, so I've at least been using my time as wisely as I can. I've been working on a Halloween project, which I'm really excited about. Now, I want to start releasing it now, but I would fuck up the project because it's something that's going to be released every day in October. So if I start releasing it now in fucking June, I'm gonna have nothing to release like in actual October. So it's gonna be like, well, what was the point then? But it's gonna be really fun, and I'm really excited to share that with everybody. And I'm working on that at the moment. I also just finished a Christmas song. I know what you're thinking. Why are you writing Christmas songs in June? Well, you know what? I started writing it in May. Well, this draft of it anyway. I started originally planning on my Christmas song for this year in April. And I did have one, but I didn't like it. I wrote something, and I thought, no, this doesn't really work for me. I'm not feeling it. I'm not into it. So I started writing another one. And I recorded it. And just got it finished really, really fucking quick. So that's that done. It is normally sooner than I would have it done. Normally, I would sort of have it done and finished around about September, because that gives you time to get approvals on things, get press and stuff sorted, and all that fun stuff that I hate interacting with. So yes, you know, June is a bit soon, but you know, at least it's done for the year. And that sounds terrible, doesn't it? Oh, Christmas done, you know, but I think I'll be more into it sort of around September time, when I can like film a video for it and that, and have some fun. And but it's about London at Christmas. I've always loved the way that London looks at Christmas. I remember the first sort of time I saw it when I was very, very young. And I was going up to London, and we'd just been to visit somebody at hospital. I can never remember whether it was Guy's Hospital or St Thomas's. I always get them mixed up. But one thing I do remember about the hospital is that there was a piano in the hospital, like in the corridor. And there was this man, and he was playing Someone to Watch Over Me by Ella Fitzgerald. And I just remember it because it made me cry. I can't tell if I was crying because I was sad that I was in a hospital visiting somebody, or just because I was sad because I couldn't have a little diva moment. I'm not really sure, to be honest. It really could have been either. But I remember that song and I remember the piano. And I did... I remember one day a couple of weeks ago, I just sat there and I looked on Google and I was typing in all kinds of things to find out if this piano was a real thing that was actually there or whether I just imagined it. And it turned out it was, but I can't now remember which of the hospitals it was. But it doesn't really matter. The point is, we went to the hospital to visit someone and then we were driving back through London. I think this was before the congestion charge. I don't remember. Anyway, so we were driving back through London and there was all the lights and everything. And my granddad was driving and he took us through so we could see all the lights to cheer us up. And it was so beautiful. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, I just want to live here, but only when it's like this. I remember when I was at uni, that was always one of my favourite things. I always loved to go into the city and see the lights at Christmas, and I loved, I never minded still having, you know, lectures and stuff in December, because Greenwich always looked very beautiful as well at Christmas, so I didn't mind. And I filmed the video for Winter Girl up in London with all the Christmas lights, if you remember. And so that was very special for me, that sort of image, I guess. And so I wrote a song about it, about wanting to go there with someone that you love and share that moment with them and make a memory with them. And but you know what? You're not going to get to hear it until Christmas. So I don't even know why I'm telling you. That's quite cruel, really, isn't it? But you know what? We're all being deprived of things we love during this time, so... sorry. But yeah, what, so I've been working on Christmas stuff, Halloween stuff, and a bunch of stuff for in between, though, you know, now and then. So I've been so fucking absurdly busy. It's been awful, but I did find time. I feel like I need to talk about this. I found time to watch Finding Dory. I watched that today, actually. And let me tell you this. I don't know why I put it off so long. I had the time of my life. I know that we've all decided Ellen DeGeneres is cancelled and that, but bloody hell, what a film. I fucking loved Finding Nemo when it came out. I loved it. I didn't think it could be... I didn't think a sequel could be that good, but it was. It was brilliant. I was emotional, you know. I had a lovely time, and it really relaxed me because I was really stressed out today and upset about a lot of different things, and it just made me feel really at peace with myself and the world around me. So thank you, Pixar, for probably stopping me committing a murder. You ask what I want. My fingers find our future. I point. Do you see? I point. Do you see my future in your fingers? So fragile, so clean. So fragile, so clean. Afraid of muddy moments. No immune system. No immune system, locked away, must keep us safe. Can we survive this? Can we survive this, I ask. You ask what I want. I want forever. I want forever. We swallow mud and grow strong. We can survive this. I'm still really into haikus, if you couldn't tell. And I'm still really into connecting first and last lines, again, if you couldn't tell. I was thinking about immune systems. I was on mum's nap, because, you know, I like to just sort of hang out there, you know, see what all the mums are saying. Just because it's amusing to me, really. It's like looking at like a completely different world, because I'm not involved in that kind of thing, and I don't think I ever will be. But just seeing all the stuff that goes along with having children and stuff, it's fascinating. That sounds terrible. It's like I'm going to the zoo. Anyway, I was on mum's net, and there was a thread where people were talking about like immune systems in kids, and how you have to let your kids get dirty and stuff so that they get stronger and they can fight off different things, because they, you know, their bodies know how to deal with it and stuff. And, well, of course, I made the whole thing about myself in my head, because I was like, well, that's an interesting idea. And I started thinking about personal relationships and how, I don't know, maybe you have to let them sort of play in the mud a bit, and then they'll be stronger when something bad happens. I don't know if that makes sense, but my thought process was kind of like, for me, I freak out when a relationship is no longer all kind of idealistic, you know, those first few weeks where you're constantly like really happy and everything, and when real life starts happening to your relationship, and you have to take notice of that, and you have to acknowledge that that is a thing that is happening, that freaks me out. And I'm like, wait, what? What do you mean there's more than two people in the world? What the fucking hell is happening? What is going on? And I'm like, I read that thread on Mum's Net, and I thought, okay, so maybe that's what I have to do. Rather than panicking and being like, all is lost, it's not like it was before, I'm just gonna run the fuck away. Maybe you play in the mud and it makes you stronger. And you go through something together, rather than, you know, panicking and thinking, oh God, what is to become of me? You think, I'm gonna get stronger, and this thing is gonna get stronger, because real life is something that is gonna happen for the rest of my life, because it's part of the terms and conditions of being alive. And so rather than convincing myself that I have to run away and I have to go and find something new that isn't affected, I can take that new antibody on, you know. And so I just sort of started thinking about it and writing about it. I stayed on Mum's Net for a bit after, though, and I found some more fun threads. I wonder if the ladies of Mum's Net and some of the dads too, there are dads there as well, I wonder if they know that there are people like me that just kind of log in every now and again and just sort of look through and be like, ooh, what's going on? What's happening? I imagine they are aware, because there are like articles that are written about Mum's Net threads, and, you know, Twitter accounts where they post like the craziest things they saw on Mum's Net. So I'm pretty sure the mums know, but maybe they're at peace with it. I don't know. Reconcile. Wreck my life down at the riverbank. Say you're so full of sense, but I've never been so confused and starved of closure. Throwing myself into the water, remaining dry as a desert. Deserted, dismal, desperate. Kiss me when I'm chaotic. Say you're so sick of being separate, but you sit inside a tower
wondering whether I was ever rational. Everyone says I'm on your mind, hiding, hoping that I'm happy. I feel listless, restless, reckless. Say I'm irreplaceable, but you never try to find me. Am I angry? The sky told me that you don't know how to approach me. My door is open, windows waiting to spy the sight of you. Mariah's on the radio saying to me, I just can't accept the possibility we weren't made for each other's arms. Wait a minute. This is too deep. I gotta change the mindset. But I don't. I never do. I think always against advice of you. I recall small sentences that used to say I was your starlight. The nighttime never ends when you're not near me, but I'm learning to see in the dark.
A couple of months ago, I started learning Gaelic on Duolingo. Do you know what? If you've listened to the show for a long time, or you know, you've been following me for a long time, you will know that learning languages is kind of a thing that I'm very interested in, but have never had all that much success with outside of the languages I already know that I learned in childhood. But like, I know I gave up really quickly with Esperanto because it was confusing, and also I was like, when am I gonna use this? Who even speaks this? So I started learning Welsh, and I had a really good time with that, and I've kept up with that actually. I did look at Hebrew, but I think that's gonna be something I can't really learn from an app, and I think I would benefit from having like an actual teacher, because I found that the lessons on the app is very overwhelming, and I was like, I don't even know where to begin. Oh my god. But Gaelic, I don't know, I just found it was so fun, and I just really kind of threw myself into it, and I just had so much fun immersing myself in that. And I think I figured out why. Okay. And this is gonna sound crazy, but when I was learning it, right? Okay. I don't know if you've ever used Duolingo, right? But like, some of the things you have to do, you have to like translate sentences from, you know, the language that you speak into the language that you're learning, and, you know, back and forth and so on. And when you when you have a sentence there in that language and then you have to translate it into English, I don't know if I'm using this term correctly or what, but obviously it, you know, different sentences are structured different ways, and so they, like, it's not that they don't mean the same thing, it's just they say it in a different way. Like, you know that meme where people are like, oh, in French we don't say I love you, we say you are my soul, and I think that's beautiful. You know that meme? It's like that. And one of the things I notice consistently is that some things that my boyfriend says, which are different to how you would say it in England, right? I don't know if I'm making sense, but like, he says things and I understand what he means, because like, you can work it out, but it's like he structures his sentences differently than how I would, having learned English in England, right? And what was so spooky and interesting was that when I started learning Gaelic, I realized all the things I was reading there, it's the same as how he talks when he speaks English, right? And he doesn't really speak Gaelic, But if it makes sense, it's like he does, but without knowing it. And now I know that because I've been learning it. And so the app basically told me that, which was really fucking rad. And but it's a really cool language. It's really interesting. And it's very beautiful. It reminds me of Welsh in a way. Sort of in the sense that when you translate things from like Welsh or Gaelic to English, they look prettier than if it was just in regular English, if that even makes sense. Like the sentence just looks nicer and friendlier, less cold and angry, if that makes sense. You know, it's like when they speak English, they seem nicer about it, which is interesting really when you think about it. But it was just so cool how I guess over the years dialects have kind of evolved, not just from the English language, but from the language that was originally in that country. And it's really cool how that happens and sort of getting to learn about it myself. But I was I don't know why I've just rambled about Duolingo for 5 minutes, but the reason I thought about that, because I was listening back to that poem, because I was thinking, what can I say about that, you know? So it was really just kind of several stanzas of sort of cathartic stuff. And then I had the line at the end about sentences, small sentences, and I was just thinking about, you know, little things that my boyfriend says that are so cute. And then I started thinking about about Duolingo. But it is weird, like little things that people can say to you that just make you feel very loved and cherished. And I think they're very important to hold on to. The government have finally backed down on primary schools reopening. They kept talking about how they were going to have them reopened before September. And teachers kept saying, no, that's not realistically going to happen. We can't implement enough measures to keep the kids safe and to keep us safe. Social distancing, all that kind of stuff. And the government was essentially demonizing teachers, as were certain parts of the press. You know, teachers are trying to deprive your kids of their education. Teachers have been pussy whipped by their unions. Oh, horrible teachers. And now the government is saying, actually, we're not going to be able to open primary schools because it's not safe to do so. There's no ability to implement the measures to keep them safe, which is exactly what teachers were saying and were demonized for. And now the government is admitting, actually, yeah, they're 100% right, actually. But, I mean, they're not admitting that. They're not saying, we were wrong, the teachers were right, we're sorry. They're just sort of quietly saying, yeah, we're not going to open schools, please don't ask questions. And so there was this huge campaign to demonise teachers. And the teachers were right. And so the teachers had to go through all that there were teachers sharing screenshots on social media of hate messages they'd received, abusive messages that they had gotten, and all of that was for nothing because the government backpedaled on it anyway and admitted, you know, sort of quietly that they were right. So it's like, well, why did you put them through that then? It doesn't make any sense. I think part of the problem with British society that has been identified through this pandemic, whether people want to admit it or not, is the way that key workers are taken for granted. A lot of teachers were essentially told, when they raised concerns about it being dangerous to reopen schools, they were basically told that there were other priorities. You know, children's education was more important than safety. Parents being able to have childcare was more important than safety. You know, stop being a horrible lefty bastard and just do your job. And this whole idea that certain workers should just forsake their safety and the safety of others around them for the greater good has been something that I have noticed a lot happening throughout this. With healthcare workers and hospital workers, that was something that happened. You know, nurses, doctors, carers, porters, cleaners, when they couldn't get the correct protective equipment, when they were being overworked, you know, when they were put in danger, rather than listening to their concerns, they were told that they were heroes. And then if they kept raising those concerns, they were demonized. And I think that the overwhelming problem here is this hero narrative. Now, that is not to say that people who do these jobs are not people to be admired, because they quite obviously are. And they should be celebrated for the important contribution they make to society. However, during this crisis, that celebration of their work has mutated into essentially ignoring their concerns, ignoring the very obvious safety issues for them, and ignoring their right to as safe a work environment as possible by just calling them heroes anytime a problem comes up. And if that doesn't work, accusing them of hating society and whatever. And if you look at these sectors, if you look at healthcare workers, you know, in the NHS, are often very low paid when you consider the importance of their work. Teachers are very low paid as well. So we call them heroes, but we don't pay them properly. We don't listen to their safety concerns. We don't make sure that they have as much safety equipment as possible to keep them and the people they work with safe. And if they continue to raise those concerns, we turn on them and we say that they don't care about us and they're being difficult. There was a really interesting episode of Panorama where they talked about essentially the way that the National Health Service had been failed by the government in terms of securing enough protective equipment. I should state, by the way, the documentary was about the NHS in England. Health is devolved in different parts of the UK, so that is a very important distinction to make. But anyway, back to the topic. And the presenter talked about the NHS clapping and the labelling of NHS workers as heroes. And he made a really interesting point that when we do that, when we
do the little weekly clap, although we don't do that anymore because it's finished. For some reason, it just ended after 10 weeks. It was really random. They were like, oh yeah, tonight's the last one, that's it. And it's like, whoa, okay, cool, but okay. And so, you know, you do the clap and you call them heroes and you put up a little rainbow in your window. And in a way that lets the public forget what they're going through and how hard their working day is, how dangerous the environment they work in can be, and the fact that it doesn't have to be like that. It really doesn't. The NHS does not have to be in a situation where there is not enough protective equipment to go around. NHS workers don't have to be in a position where they are not being paid fairly for the difficult work that they do. Teachers do not have to be in a position where they are having to essentially beg the government not to put them and their students in danger. And yet we are in those situations. And the public does have an opportunity to do something about that. It had the opportunity to do something in December and it chose not to. But we have continued opportunities, you know. Yes, we cannot currently vote out the government that is doing these things and then essentially, you know, tricking the public into demonising the teachers and the nurses and the porters by, you know, saying, oh, you know, we want to make sure that all these services run well, we want to make sure you can send your kids back to school, and we want to make sure hospitals are okay, but these horrible lefty people, they won't let us, and the unions won't let us, and these horrible, you know, nurses and doctors and teachers, and they're arguing with us and it's unfair. The government is essentially tricking us into turning on the people that we should be supporting. And they are tricking us into thinking that these people are essentially people who chose danger. And that's not the case. I think there is this issue with these sectors where people don't really see the real lives behind these jobs. You know, they look at, you know, healthcare workers, teachers, firefighters, police officers, soldiers, and they say, well, they chose a dangerous profession. Firstly, that narrative now being applied to teachers is fucking batshit, because what the fuck? Because it was never really applied to teachers before this pandemic, but it suddenly is, and it's like, whoa, what the fuck? How? But you know what? For all the other jobs, I don't feel that is a real argument, because, you know, when you enlist in the military, you do so on the understanding that as far as possible and as much as possible, you will be given what you need to keep yourself safe, right? You don't actually sign up saying, I'm going to die. That's not actually how it works. When you get a job in the NHS, you don't sign a bit of paper that says, you know, I'm totally okay with me dying if you don't make sure that I've got the equipment I need to keep myself safe. Nobody fucking does that. That's not a thing. And these workers are people, you know, they have friends, family, people that will miss them if they die. They have a life outside of their jobs. They are not sacrificial lambs to just be thrown at coronavirus and killed so that you can stay safe. But I feel like some people are kind of adopting that narrative of they knew what they were signing up for. They knew it would be dangerous, when that's not the truth, because it makes them feel a little bit better about the fact that these people are in dangerous situations for very little money, through no fault of their own. And yet some people, you know, want to push that further. And they feel bad about that because they know it's wrong. But it's easier to believe the narrative that the bad guys are actually the teachers and the doctors and everything. I mean, I don't have kids, as you know. However, I understand the difficulty that parents face in terms of childcare, especially parents who are in, who are working in sectors where they now are being told to go back to work. I do understand that it is difficult. However, trying to pressure teachers into accommodating more students than they safely can to help with your childcare needs is selfish. And these teachers are not saying these things to be difficult or to be annoying. They're saying it to try and keep the kids that they are caring for as safe as possible. So when you demonize those teachers, when you attack them because you are being inconvenienced, your anger is really misdirected, to be honest, because it is not the teacher's fault that they cannot put those measures in place. And really, the government sold you a lie. They told you it could be done and it couldn't. And you can't really blame the teachers who are trying to keep everyone safe for that. In the same way, you know, in terms of the NHS, there are some people who are angry because they have had to wait longer for non-coronavirus related treatments and things like that. And so despite being the same people who are out, you know, who are out there clapping every Thursday, they're sitting, you know, on social media being angry at nurses. They are angry at nurses that criticize the government and doctors that criticize the government. They are doing the best with what they have. And to be honest, healthcare workers have been doing that for a long time. They've been doing the best with what they have for a very long time. And I understand if you are having a bad experience with our healthcare system, it's frustrating, you're going to lash out. But is your anger directed at the right person? And I feel like that is a lesson we should learn from coronavirus. Is your anger directed at the right person? Are you angry with the right person? If you are, you know, having long waiting times in hospitals, is it because the doctors and nurses and support workers are being horrible bastards and just want to purposely inconvenience you? Or is it because they are incredibly short-staffed because of budget cuts, because of a lack of focus on retention of staff? Like, it's more likely to be the second one, let's be real, isn't it? You know, if you want to send your kids back to school now because you have to work and, you know, you need childcare, is the problem that the government sold you a lie and told you it was possible when it wasn't? Or is the problem teachers who are trying to keep your kids safe? Because I'm pretty sure that people would prefer to have to maybe have the inconvenience of trying to figure out something with the kids than their kids getting sick. Like I said, I don't have kids, but if I did, I wouldn't want to send them to an environment where they would potentially be unsafe. Personally, I don't know. But I mean, it's just interesting that the government spent so long demonizing teachers who were trying to protect others and do the right thing, And now they're essentially saying the exact same thing as those teachers. And it will be interesting to see if all the people that were sending hate and abuse to teachers are going to apologise to those teachers, advocate for those teachers perhaps, or whether they will just accept the message when it comes from somebody else. I need to tell you about a tweet I saw last night. I'm recording this quite early in the week, actually. It's Tuesday. So there was a film that was on the BBC this week, Sitting in Limbo. If you're in the UK and you haven't seen it, you can check it out on iPlayer. If you're outside the UK, I don't know. I don't know if iPlayer is available outside. I'm not too sure. Some places have said it is, some haven't. I don't know. Anyway, it is a really great film about the effects of the Windrush generation and the Windrush scandal. For those who aren't aware of what that is, it was basically people from the Caribbean were invited to come to the UK in the 1960s to come and live and work in the UK on the understanding that they could stay because they were helping to rebuild the UK and to take jobs where there was a lot of staffing shortages. So, you know, they come here and then they're British because they're contributing, they're working, and you know, it sounds like a pretty fair deal to me. The problem was, in 2010, the documents that that detailed their right to be in the UK and to remain in the UK were destroyed because somebody thought that was a good idea. I don't know why anyone would seriously think that destroying documents that important was a good idea, but somebody did, and so that was a bit shit, obviously. The problem then became worse when Theresa May, you remember her, was Home Secretary, and she brought in what was called the hostile environment. And what that meant is that the government made it harder to do a lot of things without identity documents that displayed your right to work. So the idea behind it was essentially to make it so difficult to live and work in the UK without identity documents that it would essentially force people who are in the UK illegally to leave, because you would have to show your right to work for, you know, renting housing, for benefits applications, job applications and everything like that. And so the idea was to drive down illegal immigration. The Conservative government were told this is going to have an effect on people outside of who you're targeting, because there are some people that don't have that documentation through no fault of their own, but they are here legally. And that included the Windrush generation. But the government pushed ahead with it anyway. And then what it led to was a lot of the people who had come as part of the Windrush generation and were here legally being detained, and even in some cases being deported, because they had to prove that they had the right to be in the UK. But the proof that they had the right to be in the UK had been destroyed. So for the most part, they couldn't do that. And it led to people being detained in immigration detention centres. It led to people losing their jobs, losing their homes. And like I said, in some cases, it led to people being deported when they shouldn't have been. There were some people who, after they had been deported, they had died and they'd never been able to make it back home to the UK. And this was a huge scandal that was publicised because the media dug into it, essentially. They spoke to people that had been affected by what had happened and told their stories. And the government was essentially shamed into admitting what they had done. And then from there, there was investigations. There has been a compensation scheme set up. But to be quite honest, I have never really thought that anything that has been done since has been adequate. But nevertheless, so there was a film on last night, Sitting in Limbo. It was a very good film, but it was very hard to watch. But I would recommend that people do. And everybody was talking about it on social media. It was trending for hours and hours after it aired, because people were so moved by what had happened. And then Priti Patel logged on, the current Home Secretary, and she had this to say. Sitting in limbo epitomises the unimaginable suffering endured by the Windrush generation. Yeah, sis, you think? On behalf of successive governments, I apologise again to victims and their families. I will do all I can to ensure the Home Office protects and listens to every part of the community it serves. That's a bit fucking cheeky, don't you think? Because if you watch the film, it makes clear that a lot of the apologies and the action taken by the Home Office in regards to this, even after Priti Patel became Home Secretary, have been performative and for show. At the end of the film, it gives an update on the Windrush scandal and what's been happening for the victims. And this part was really, I mean, Jesus. The Home Office revealed in May 2020, so that is just last month, that there had been 1,275 applications to the Windrush compensation scheme. Which is fair enough. You know, these are people who lost their jobs, in some cases lost their homes, in some cases were detained and deported, went through unimaginable trauma through no fault of their own. I think they are definitely entitled to compensation, right? Of these, so that's of 1,275 applications, only 60 had received any compensation. 60 people. Out of 1,275. And that number, 1,275, that is only people who have applied. It is very possible that some people who suffered because of this didn't actually apply because, well, would you want to interact with the government that traumatized you like that? I personally wouldn't. You know, and for Priti Patel to be logging on and tweeting this performative nonsense is so fucking... This girl has the audacity, let me just say that. I mean, the film itself was about a man called Anthony Bryan. It's about his story and what happened to him. He was wrongly detained for several weeks with no explanation as to why he was there or what he had done wrong. And he hasn't actually received any compensation yet at all. It's been years since this happened to him. He went through repeated traumatic experiences at the hands of the Home Office. They wouldn't tell him why he was detained. They wouldn't tell him what he had done wrong. They were very unhelpful when he was trying to prove to them that he had the right to remain like they wanted him to. And all he gets is promises of one day you'll get compensation and a cringe tweet from Priti Patel. I mean, it's just so fucking cheeky. It's like, log off, sis. You don't have the right to speak on this when your department is currently still failing these people. Like, that is the reality of the situation. You know, and some of the things that the Windrush generation had to endure, being detained with no explanation, the horrific treatment, that is still happening now. The Home Office is still doing that. They are still doing that to people. Voluntary return is still something that they are trying to persuade people to take. You know, so that they will not appeal their detention and their deportation. So they'll say to them, oh, you can voluntarily return. And do you know what? The journalist, actually, that helped bring a lot of attention to this, Amelia Gentleman, she was live tweeting and she talked about voluntary return. And she said about how some people from the Windrush generation agreed to that because they were so tormented by the Home Office. And Priti Patel thinks that that goes away by her tweeting some nonsense and failing to deliver on the compensation scheme. Girl, shut up. I don't understand why she came on and tweeted this. It's so, just the audacity, really. It's like, you could have just kept your mouth shut, sis. You didn't need to live tweet this film about your department's incompetence. You could have just been quiet. You really, really could. Speaking of incompetence, so the Black Lives Matter protests have been happening here in the UK, as you may have noticed, including a rather cool moment where people in Bristol took down a statue of a slave trader and threw it in the fucking river. We had to stand. There are some people who are arguing like, oh, they should have gone through the proper channels, they should have done it democratically. And the people of Bristol are like, bitch, we tried. Do you know what? I fucking stand Bristol now. I didn't expect this of them because, you know, you don't really see about Bristol in the news and stuff. They're kind of doing their own thing, they're keeping themselves to themselves, being quiet. I'm surprised by them and I am in awe of them. But they made it clear they had been petitioning their local authority for a very long time to have the statue taken down and nothing was happening. So direct action, bitch. We love to see it. But yeah, so protests have been happening across the UK, some more socially distanced than others. And Boris Johnson decided he needed to speak. What is it with Tories this week talking about things they have no business poking their noses into? What is this? Mr. fucking watermelon smiles, Mr. pickaninnies, Mr. Muslim women look like letterboxes decides he wants to weigh in on racism. This bitch, honestly, he did a whole fucking video on the Twitter. This is how he captioned it. Let me just say this. Let us work peacefully and lawfully to defeat racism and discrimination wherever we find it. You know where we find it, Boris? In Boris Johnson's house, in fucking Downing Street, where you live, because you are racist. You have openly made racist remarks repeatedly through your adult life. You have refused to apologize for these things. You don't get to sit here and lecture anyone on racism, you fucking racist. He continues, and let us continue to work together as we put Britain back on its feet. Bitch, work together. What, work together to carry you outside of Downing Street and dump you on the road where you belong? Because that's the only option. And you know the worst part? This bitch didn't even brush his hair again. He's still doing his whole buffoon dad shtick, you know. Oh, I'm so goofy and funny. Please don't criticize me because I look like a clown. But it's so patronizing at this point because we all know why he's doing that. We know that it's a scam. We know it's an act. So the fact he continues to do it, and the fact that he's making a video on a very serious subject while looking like he's just been dragged backwards through a hedge, is insulting. I can't stand him, honestly, truly. But he is, honestly, he's really out here looking a mess, still refusing to apologize for racist things he has done. And then he wants to discuss racism. Look in the mirror, because that's going to solve both your problems. First, you're going to realize your hair looks messy. Secondly, you're going to realize that the problem is you. So I'm just saying, that is all I am saying, because the whole thing is messy and grim and I hate it. It's just, I've had enough, honestly. And then Boris Johnson's spokesperson said this: the Prime Minister doesn't doubt that there continues to be discrimination and racism. Yeah, the calls are coming from inside the house. But does not agree that this is a racist country. We have made very significant progress on this issue, but there remains more to do. We will not be complacent in our efforts to stamp out racism and discrimination where it happens. Okay, well, you bitches better get stamping down to Downing Street then, because, yike-a-doodles. Keir Starmer, he's had a bit of a drama week, because this statue of Edward Colston, the slave trader of Bristol, that was torn down by the people, he condemned that. He did a little radio phone-in for LBC, and he was saying a lot of things that some of his members did not like. He said about the statue business, nobody should condone the lawlessness. The statue shouldn't come down in that way. So he was basically saying that the public should have petitioned their local government, which they did, Mark Darcy. He also said Barry Gardner shouldn't have gone to a Black Lives Matter protest. Barry Gardner, a Labour MP, went to a Black Lives Matter protest that didn't have social distancing. And so I think the lack of social distancing was Keir Starmer's problem with that, rather than him going to the protest as a whole. Keir Starmer pissing off his members. I mean, personally, I think he's wrong about the statue. Because it is very clear, you know, the people of Bristol have come with receipts. You know, there are so many of them talking about this openly and saying, you know, we tried to do it that way. We tried to talk with the local government and they refused to help us for years. So this is where we are. So I do think there really was no other option for them. And but I think maybe he's not in a position where he can say that. Because when you are the leader of a political party, it's a bit difficult. You do have to kind of be the boring dad and, you know, say things like that. However, a lot of people are making the argument that the statue should have stayed up because it could have been educational. And people were saying you could rewrite the wording on the statue to explain what this man had done and make it educational. However, the public had tried that as well. And wording that was accurate and honest would not be agreed by the local government. So, again, the public tried that. Even though it was quite an unfair ending on them, because why should the public have to see a massive and traumatic reminder of a terrible person every time they walk down the street? But they were willing to compromise. And even when they were willing to compromise, they were met with refusal. So, you know, what are they supposed to do? Anyway, this could easily be solved. I saw a tweet about putting up statues of Paddington everywhere, and I feel like that would solve the problem, because Paddington is an unproblematic, woke Latin legend who is polite, resourceful, and awesome. So I am totally here for that. Do you guys remember last week when I was talking about Richard Lennon's big plans? And he was like, we're going to oppose independence. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. It's going to be amazing. Well, he's not having a good week. Because polling was released for Scotland in terms of voting at both Westminster and at the Scottish Parliament. And in both cases, Labour is in third place behind the SNP and the Conservatives. The SNP looks like they're going to dominate at both the Scottish Parliament elections and in terms of Scottish seats at the next Westminster election. So, you know, Richard came up with all those plans for no fucking reason, because, like, the boy is still going to have no influence. It's funny to me. That's all. That's all I'm going to say. It's just, I mean, maybe he should stop calling voters stupid, just as a thought, just as an idea. But speaking of people who should be called stupid, Ben Bradley. Ben Bradley is the Conservative MP for Mansfield. He describes himself on his Twitter account as the first blue brick in the red wall. Okay. I mean, that's just a bit cringe, really. And he tweeted this in regards to the statue. It's like he was subtweeting the people that tore down the statue. If we start to judge historical figures by 21st century standards, we'll find that quite a few folks weren't that nice, almost as if they don't know any better, with like a suspicious emoji. There was a typo in this, but I'm not going to take the piss out of that, because I make typos all the time, and he could be, you know, dyslexic, or maybe it was just a typo, and it's not nice to make fun of people for that, when you can make fun of their stupid opinions instead. So that's what we're going to do, kids. Because empathy was not invented in the 21st century. Right? This idea that people didn't know that enslaving other people was wrong is stupid. Because they could still look at people and see that they are people. And they can imagine themselves in their shoes and say, well, how would I feel if that was me? These ideas and these concepts, you know, putting yourself in someone else's shoes, or, you know, just being a person who looks at another person,
and feels empathy. That's not a new thing. I don't understand why we're being like, oh, people back then didn't know that human rights abuses were wrong. Fucking cancel culture. Fucking shut up, Ben Bradley. I mean, I don't understand why we're pretending that things like racism and literal human enslavement and murder and misogyny and homophobia and things like that were acceptable back then because, oh, people didn't know any better. Well, all of these things, right, all of them require you to ignore that the other person is a person. They require you to ignore that human instinct of empathy and kindness, right? That's not a new thing. Being kind to other people, having empathy, looking at someone and saying, you're a human like me, you deserve rights and safety and happiness and everything else. That's not a new thing that was suddenly available to people in 2005. You know, it didn't just pop up and be like, oh, did you know you can actually be nice to other people? Did you know that you don't actually have to hate people based on their skin colour or their sexuality or their gender identity? I had no idea. I've only just found out. Ben Bradley, you know, he just told me on Twitter. I'm really shocked. It's fucking stupid. People back then knew that slavery was wrong, but they did it anyway because they wanted to be rich. Okay, so yes, I will judge them by 21st century standards because empathy is timeless. Do you know what? I wasn't going to talk about this, but I'm going to fucking do it anyway. So Saturday, which is today as I'm recording this part, there was originally supposed to be a Black Lives Matter protest in London. But it was cancelled because Tommy Robinson and quite a lot of his supporters said that they would be coming to London for, I mean, they kept saying they were going to protect the statues from people, basically. Obviously there was the Bristol statue kerfuffle situation, and Tommy and the lads have obviously decided that they need to defend these statues like they are their wives. Thoughts and prayers with the wives, let me just say that. And so they were going to come up on Saturday and defend the statues. Tommy Robinson then released a video saying that he wasn't going to be there because, well, do you know what? His reason for not going wasn't very clear because he looked very, he was having a moment, let's just say that. A moment that included lots of sniffing and touching his nose. Let's just say that. Anyway, so it's not really clear why he didn't go in the end, but he said he wasn't going. Black Lives Matter cancelled the protest because there was a lot of threats made towards them. So they said it was safer for people not to go, which I think is fair enough. And yet, Tommy's supporters still went. And so, lots of... I mean, I don't even know what their cause is supposed to be outside of fascism, because they didn't seem to have a point. You know, Black Lives Matter weren't there, so there's nothing to counter protest. So what are they doing there? You know, they say they're turning up to protect the statues, but the statues were already protected. There were police at all the statues. The statues had been covered up, you know, with some massive grey thing, so the statues weren't in danger. There was nothing to counter protest. So what is their cause? What are they doing there? Nobody knows. But they'd still turned up and wow. Let me just start by saying there was an obvious lack of social distancing. There was also quite a lot of public binge drinking, which, you know, is illegal, but I think that was probably the least of the police's worries, to be honest. There was quite a lot of threatening language. There was some Nazi salutes going on. There's, you know, these people keep calling them protesters, but I mean, what were they protesting? There was no counter protest for them to do because there was no other protest group there. It's obviously not to do with statues because the statues were fine. So I don't think you can call it a protest if people just turn up, get drunk and, you know, lash out at other people. I don't think that's what a protest is. But everyone keeps calling them protesters. Anyway. So basically they just turned up, got drunk, did some Nazi salutes, and then beat up police officers and journalists. And and it's interesting, you know, because Boris Johnson, when there was violence at the Black Lives Matter protests, and it was a very small number of people, might I add, and the evidence that we have, the videos, the pictures, the testimonies from people who were there, make it obvious that it was a very small number of people at those protests that became violent. Boris was straight on Twitter calling people thugs, talking shit, you know. But where is this bitch when the majority of this, not a protest, but everyone's calling it a protest, by these far-right groups, the majority of the people involved are beating up journalists and police officers. Where is Boris on that? You know, has he lost his password for Twitter? Has he lost his phone? Like, where is this bitch? I mean, there was a video in particular that I found really distressing, of some of these people laughing and cheering after they had broken a journalist's nose and the journalist was having to be helped over the barriers to get away so that they could A, be safe, and B, get medical help. And they're laughing because they did that. I mean, what the fuck? What the actual fuck is wrong with these people? And I know, you know what, some people, they'll say, oh, well, you know, when you say things like that and you're mean to them, you're just radicalising them further because they'll just think you're the metropolitan elite. Fuck off. I am not the metropolitan elite. But if I see a thick bastard being stupid, I'm going to fucking call it out. And if I see someone being violent for the sake of being violent, I'm going to fucking say something about it. And I don't care if that makes them feel bad and then they hate people like me even more. Because it doesn't matter what I say, they're not going to change their mind, right? There were people saying, oh, the reason they're doing this is the Black Lives Matter protests. That's not true. They were kicking off and attacking journalists and police officers at the Free Tommy marches a couple of months ago when Tommy landed himself in prison by being a stupid cunt. You know, honestly, they will turn up and beat up journalists and police officers at any opportunity. They don't give a fuck. Like, just give them a time and a place and they'll do it. They're not doing this because of some cause or because of how they feel. They're doing it because they want to do it. They will come up with a bunch of reasons to justify it, but they're going to do it anyway. So me calling them stupid or calling them violent or calling them terrible is not making the situation worse. It's just me stating a fact. okay? And these people are never going to change their mind about how they feel about someone like me. It doesn't matter how nice I am to them. It doesn't matter if I appease them and treat them like children and make excuses for them. They are still going to hate me based on the color of my skin. So I am not going to appease these violent thugs who, honestly, they don't care about causes. They don't care about social change. They just came to fuck shit up. And that's just the facts. It's just interesting that they don't get labeled in the same way as other people. That's all I'm going to say. That is all I'm going to say. I wonder if Boris will be logging on. Will Miss Boris be logging on? I don't know. I guess we'll see.
I don't know why I'm surprised by The Sun about this, but I mean, fucking hell. It's grim. So, J.K. Rowling, I'm never sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I read all the Harry Potter books as a kid, but I just don't really know how to pronounce her name. But you know who I mean, obviously. Miss Joanne, she wrote Harry Potter, among other things. So she has been in this whole situation lately. She has spoken about trans people quite a lot lately, and there has been a lot of backlash for that. I'm going to be talking more about that aspect, actually, a bit later in the week on Diverse Verse. But right now, I wanted to talk about one of the things specifically that she talked about and how some people reacted to that. So she wrote this essay talking about her viewpoint and everything, and she talked about her experiences with domestic violence. And then The Sun, which is a newspaper, allegedly, here in the UK, for those outside the UK that don't know what it is, it's a tabloid, pretty right-wing newspaper. They decided to devote their cover for their issue on Friday to the man that abused her. It's just so fucking gross. The headline they used with a picture of her with her first husband who abused her. And the headline, "I slapped JK and I'm not sorry." And they've got a picture of them on their wedding day. They said Sun confronts her first husband. But to be honest, this didn't need to happen. If she wants to confront the man that abused her herself, that is her right. She doesn't need some fucking tabloid weighing in, giving this man a platform in a national newspaper and making a really fucked up attempt to confront him. I don't feel that they were doing this because they cared about her as a victim of domestic violence. I think they thought that this would increase their circulation numbers, increase the number of copies that they sold today by having this big story. You know, oh, we found the man that beat up this, you know, beloved author, and we're going to interview him. Why do they think people want to hear from this person? The Mail got in on it as well. They had a picture of them on the cover. I slapped JK but didn't abuse her. Bizarre claim by Rowling's ex. Again, we did not need to fucking hear from this man. We don't. It's hard to talk about this kind of thing happening to you. It is one of the hardest things. And she did that. So I don't understand why two separate newspapers, in response to that, went and sought out this man and gave him a fucking platform and splashed his words and pictures of him across the front of their newspapers. That's traumatic for her, for her family, because it's not just traumatic for the person who has been abused, but the people around them feel that too. And so now they have to look at that as well. She has to look at that. They have to look at that. People who have been victims of domestic violence across the UK have to look at that. And that trauma comes back. And for what? For a quick little sales bump? You think that platforming an abuser and monetizing somebody's trauma is worth that? I know I shouldn't be surprised. These are not exactly reputable, good outlets that have a great reputation for being good people. They're not. I mean, the Mail for years has made money by scapegoating and bullying basically anybody that's different, as has the Sun. The Sun also has a history of monetizing people's tragedy. What they did to the people of the Hillsborough disaster was horrific. So maybe I shouldn't be surprised that this is something that they do, and that they sink to these lengths, and that they platform an abusive person and they take somebody else's trauma to benefit themselves. And they completely irresponsibly report domestic violence. Especially now at a time when, you know, because of the current lockdown and travel restrictions, there are people who are essentially trapped at home with abusive partners. That's a horrible thing to think about, but it is a reality for some people. And so the fact that they would do this, it shouldn't surprise me, because everything that they've done really kind of spells out that this is the kind of thing that they would do. But fucking hell, I mean, it's just, I mean, it
It's unfortunate. I think it is a symptom as well of a bigger problem in the way that domestic violence is covered in the media as a whole. A lot of the time, you know, when there are stories, and I wish that there weren't so many stories like this and so many examples for me to pull from, but when you see media reports about somebody who has killed their partner, and they've previously been abusive, there's an attempt to humanize the violent person and to tell their story and to almost excuse what they did and to try and make it seem different to how it is. And this is a perpetual thing. And it doesn't matter how many times, you know, domestic abuse charities call it out, the public calls it out. Professionals who work with domestic abuse survivors every day call it out. The media keeps doing it. And I don't think that you can really look at any publication or outlet and say that they are not guilty of doing it. But I think the Sun has just taken it to a new fucking level. And the Mail, by having the abuser be given a direct platform, treating this person as if he deserves a right to respond and to, you know, to talk about these things and to make his own case and justify what he did. I mean, Jesus, the whole thing is just horrific. And I really hope that she hasn't seen it, but I'm pretty sure that she will have, unfortunately. Because I mean, that's just the way it is, you know. Because it's everywhere, you know. Obviously it's on the cover of two newspapers. It's all over social media, so unfortunately I think she probably will have seen it. And this is not the first time that this man has been given a platform either. The Daily Express has previously given him a platform where he got to talk about, you know, their relationship, and he was trying to take credit for her work and saying that he helped her to, you know, create the stories that made her famous. You know, and that, to be honest, is like peak abusive behavior, really. It's very textbook, you know. They'd be nothing without me. I created them. They're making up this stuff about me. It's very textbook, and yet he's been given a platform to do this shit before, and now he's been given a platform to defend abusing her. He openly says, yes, I hit her, but it's not abuse. I mean, it's just, and the media has a responsibility here. They never had to give him a platform at any fucking point. He is not relevant. He is not, you know, a celebrity in his own right. He is just some guy. But because of the way that celebrity culture is shaped now, platforms will be given to people that are not relevant if they have details on somebody that is. And so he is being repeatedly given a platform just because of his connection to her. And now that platform has mutated to the point where he is able to stand there and justify his violence towards somebody. And I don't know what we do about that, really, because I think the public has partly a responsibility in this as well. We have to not engage with this kind of content. We have to reject this kind of content so that the media learns that it's not profitable to do this kind of shit. But I mean, each of us is only one person. And I think it's going to take a long time before we reach a point where we can stop the media from doing this, where we can force a change in this kind of coverage, in this kind of culture. But I think we have to, because right now what has happened is that men and women who are abusive to their partners have seen that cover, and they will take it how they want to take it. So they might look at that and say, well, maybe he's got a point. Maybe she did something to deserve it. Maybe he had no choice. Maybe he was just angry and upset. It happens. And that's how I feel. So what I do is okay. And that continues that cycle of abuse. Men and women who are being abused by their partners will see that cover and they will be afraid. They will be traumatized. They will think that no one is going to believe them. They will think that no one is going to care about them, because one of the biggest newspapers in the country has just given a platform to an abuser to justify what they did. So we have to do something, because we cannot continue in a society where abusers feel vindicated to continue abusing others, and where abuse victims feel that they will not be given support and help if they talk about what's happening to them. We can't allow that to continue. We can't allow more people to be hurt and killed just because the media won't catch up and realise that actually domestic abuse is quite bad.
Last time you took a souvenir as you left, I was asleep, eyes closed, not seeing you steal segments of my soul, sweet and serene, wrapped in the brightest days. You walked into the night, no goodbyes, no route back. You go back to being alone, barely alive, staring at the small part of my soul that you stole, sometimes wilted and wounded. The brightest days banished. You ask the air if I still miss you. Nobody answers, everything echoes. You haunt me and I hate you until I don't. I dared myself to hold my fate in my hands. After midnight, mixing drinks, mixing emotions, meeting the door under the moonlight. One shoe out before you awoke, arms around the dream we had. Holding on to something you can't commit to. In the midst of missing me, you sob in a circle, alleviating your addiction for just a second before you fall back in, and I forget myself. I can never tell if you miss me or if you miss the way that I love you. Don't ask me where my heart resides, as if you don't know.
I keep the key to the rest of my life around my neck, but it's just jewelry to me, because you are my home, even when you're gone.
I remember really specifically writing that. It was a couple of weeks ago, actually, so it's quite old, really, in terms of, you know, sort of timelines. But it was really late at night, like sort of more early hours of the morning, really. And I had been watching a video on YouTube. It was a pick a card tarot reading. I'm actually really freaked out about those at the moment. But I'm not going to stop watching them because I'm a fiend. But at the moment, like, every single one that I watch, I'm watching from, like, different creators all across the platform, from people from all different parts of the world. And it doesn't matter which video I click, which option I pick, like, they're all, like, I keep getting really similar messages and narratives. And even when I do stuff for myself, it, the same thing happens, and it's really weird, but, like, good. Anyway, so I was watching one a couple of weeks ago when I wrote this, and she said something that really made me think a lot about how, it was about me as a person, and she said that when I truly love somebody, they take part of me with them. And I was thinking about that a lot, and I was thinking about, reaching that point where you trust somebody with that, and you don't worry anymore, and you think, it's okay, I trust them with that part of me. And I trust that they'll look after it, you know. And it was quite interesting to think about. And I had a little lie down for a bit, and I listened to some soundscapes, and I just sort of, I had all these images in my head of this kind of journey that a person takes, and they come home and they realize that they're safe and they're okay. And then I just started writing, and it was very relaxing.
Thank you for listening to Sincerely Jennifer with me, Jennifer Wan. If you want to find more of my work, you can on my website, jenniferwan.com, or you can find me on social media, on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Reddit, SoundCloud, and pretty much every social media website ever with the username Miss J Squared. Thank you to my amazing top tier Patreon supporters, Amanda, Kylie, Melissa, Anna, Sam, Katie, Christina, Josie, Gabriella, David, Eleanor, Alicia, Emily, Andy, and Tyler. I'll see you next time.